Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. In this week's episode, our speaker explores some of the world's most daunting economic and political challenges and shines the spotlight on successful efforts to tackle them. We'll hear from Jonathan Tepperman. He's managing editor of Foreign Affairs and author of a book entitled The Fix: How Nations Survive and Thrive in a World in Decline. He'll be in conversation with Annie Maxwell, president of the Skoll Global Threats Fund. This event was held in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. This broadcast is made possible by the generous support of Chevron. And now to Annie Maxwell and Jonathan Tepperman.
Well, good evening, and thank you everyone for joining us. I'm Annie Maxwell, and it's my great pleasure to introduce tonight's guest, Jonathan Tepperman. Jonathan is the managing editor at Foreign Affairs, and he has spent close to 20 years working on international affairs as an editor, writer, and analyst. Mr. Tepperman has written for a range of publications, including Foreign Affairs, The New York Times, Washington Post, and others, on subjects ranging from international affairs to municipal politics to food and fashion, which maybe we will get into tonight. Tonight, though, we're primarily here to talk about his most recent book, The Fix: How Nations Survive and Thrive in a World in Decline. Please join me in welcoming Jonathan Tepperman. So, Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us tonight. You've been a journalist for almost 20 years, and yet this is your first book. So, why a book, and why now?
First of all, thank you, Annie, and thank all of you for coming. It's great to see such a big turnout on a Thursday night to hear a talk about a wonky book. So I'm thrilled that you're all here. So why 20 years before a book? Because I was terrified to start. Why did I finally decide to write a book? Because there's a substantive and a non-substantive answer to that question. The non-substantive answer, which is, of course, the real one, is that I was really, really off about something. And that something was, in 2013, I finally got one of my big breaks as a writer. I was asked to write a guest column for the International Herald Tribune. Those of you who travel know that the International Herald Tribune doesn't exist anymore. It was taken over by the New York Times, which owned it and rebranded the International New York Times. And I had the misfortune of getting my column about 2 weeks before they announced the rebranding. And part of the rebranding was that they took over the editorial operations of the IHT, and part of that meant they fired all the columnists who had just been hired. So I no sooner had gotten my big break and started writing this column than all of a sudden I had it taken away from me for reasons that had nothing to do with the content of the column itself. And I was so mad because I was sure that this was going to be the thing in my career that changed everything. And so I went around for a few weeks in this state of rage plotting the destruction of the New York Times, and then decided I probably wouldn't succeed. And I thought, okay, I have to do something a little more constructive. Maybe I can find another outlet to run the column. And I thought, no, Tepperman, you sort of have done that now. It's time to finally do that thing that you've been scared of for so long, and that's write the book. I think had I not been so angry, I wouldn't have had the courage to finally climb the mountain. Why this book in particular? It came out of an intuition and a frustration that I had felt for a long time reading and thinking about international affairs. The intuition was that things are not as bad as we're constantly being told. The conventional wisdom for some time now is that we're living in this time of terrible and maybe even terminal decline for the United States, for the international system, for the world, that things are getting worse and worse and worse, and that all of the indicators are pointing in the wrong direction. And I have long felt like that's not true or not accurate, but I didn't really have the evidence to back it up. The frustration was with my colleagues in the media who were responsible for this narrative, but also with the literature in international affairs and books about the world, which tend to be focused on problems almost exclusively, and spend very little time proposing solutions. And you see this actually in all sorts of writing about the world, whether it's newspaper columns or books. When solutions, on the rare occasions when solutions are posited, they're done at such a sort of high level of abstraction that it's hard to figure out how to actually implement them. And that had also always kind of bugged me. And so I thought, well, maybe I can try and address both of these feelings of mine. One, try to prove this intuition of mine that things are actually not so bad. And two, to write the kind of book that I wished more people had been writing. And it was also, you know, an exercise in keeping myself honest, because as someone who edits a foreign policy magazine and thinks and writes about this stuff, I do spend a lot of my time, and have spent a lot of my time, criticizing government policies. And what I've tried, never having worked in government myself, unlike Annie, one of the ways I've tried to keep myself honest is by saying to myself regularly, okay, Tepperman, like, if you're so smart and you can see all the flaws in X policy, how would you do things differently? And so that got me really interested in the sort of the nuts and bolts answers that I tried to explore in the book.
And one of the things I find really interesting about the book is that it is both very data-driven. For those who haven't read it, I highly recommend it. And you'll also notice that, you know, like the back third is the references. So there's a lot of data behind this. But it is also...
That's where you're supposed to mention that the book will be on sale.
Oh, yeah, on sale afterwards. I have two copies. But it is also fundamentally storytelling.
Right.
So how did you go about trying to kind of balance these two things, both telling a very human story with also a very data-driven story?
Well, I wanted a book that people would read.
Yeah.
And that I would find interesting. And I've been in this game long enough to know that that means telling stories. And so that was going to be the focus of the book. I wanted to write a book that would have as broad appeal as possible for a book about how governments solve problems. But I also wanted a book that the people in my field would take seriously. And trying to square that circle was tricky. I made sure that all the stories were told rigorously with all the data, such that people who study this stuff for a living would at least take it seriously.
Mm. And one of the stories I think that you start with is the story of Canada, and this is particularly I think poignant right now because you talk about how they've handled immigration, and as we've seen, I think in the U.S. and particularly in the EU, this is something that we're really struggling with globally. Could you talk a little bit about that and what Trudeau did there?
Sure. So, you know, this is an extraordinary moment to be Canadian living in the United States, because Canadians my age, at least, and I know that there's one other Canadian in the room who grew up in the same border town that I did, Windsor, Ontario. So I had a very bi-national existence. And for most of my life, I was used to Americans making fun of the fact that I was Canadian. Now, all of a sudden, being Canadian is cool for the first time in my life. So much so that when we were putting the book together, my editor came to me and said, you know, I think we're going to change your bio and list the fact that you're Canadian first. And I said, why are you going to do... And he said, because it's actually a selling point. And I said, you've got to be kidding me. But, you know, so the fact that Canada is getting things right, a number of major things right, especially immigration, right now is no longer a surprise. I think a lot of Americans and people around the world now have come to recognize that. It's also the case that one country has escaped the populist and xenophobic backlash against immigration that's sweeping the rest of the developed world right now, and that's also Canada. What got me so interested in the story, however, is that Canada wasn't always like the noble, enlightened Canada of today. And when I started looking into the story, I very quickly discovered that as recently as the 1950s, Canada was as nasty a white, parochial, racist democracy as could be. The country had an explicitly racist immigration policy called White Canada, which tells you pretty much everything you need to know. It was not a reference to the snow. Canada had distinguished between three classes of immigrants: preferred, which were folks who came from Northern Europe and the UK, who were let in under any circumstances. The second category were people, the swarthier types from Southern Europe, who were let in during manpower crises. And then there was the rest of the world, who were effectively banned at all time. So I got really interested in this question: how did that Canada become today's Canada, a country which has among the highest per capita rates of immigration in the world, about twice the U.S. level, which has among the highest percentage of foreign-born residents of any country in the world, again, about twice the level in the United States, Germany, Sweden, countries that are seen as immigrant-friendly. Two of the last three governors general to Canada not only came to the country as immigrants, but as refugees. Speaking of refugees, Canada has admitted something like three times as many Syrians in the last year as has the United States, despite the fact that Canada has one-tenth the population of the U.S. So that's Canada today. So I started looking into the story of how the bad Canada became the good Canada, and what I discovered is that Canada didn't change because it was enlightened. It didn't change because Canadians are simply better than people anywhere else in the world, although that is an argument that my mom in Ontario makes to this day and will make to her death, I'm sure. Canada changed because it had to. And I love this idea that I discovered in the chapter, that Canadian virtue was born not of nobility, but of necessity. What I'm talking about is as follows. So Canadian immigration policy finally started to change in the mid-1960s, just before Pierre Elliott Trudeau, who's the father of the current prime minister, was elected himself in 1968. And the reason that Canada was forced to change is because the country was booming, so it had a great need for workers. It was competing against the United States, which was also booming at the time. And yet its preferred source for white workers, namely Europe, had just stopped exporting them because Europe had finally recovered from World War II. So Canada needed bodies, and it couldn't get the right sort of people anymore. So it had to open up. So the government dropped all of its racial criteria from its immigration policy in 1965 and adopted the world's first colorblind immigration system, which emphasized the economic factors over things like family reunification, which is the system that we use in the United States to this day. And the thing about family reunification is, while it has a sort of intuitive appeal, it lets an arbitrary factor, which is whether your relatives had the dumb luck to get into the country before you, shape the whole country's immigration population. And Canada took a much more rational approach. It set established a nine criteria test. These were factors like, did you speak English or French? What was your level of education? What were your job skills? Did your particular abilities meet Canada's needs at the time? And anybody who scored above a certain level got in, and anybody who didn't, it didn't matter the color of your skin, and it didn't matter where you came from. That immediately started to produce huge changes in the complexion of Canada's immigrant population. Until 1955 or so, Canadian immigrants, 96% of them had come from Europe. And by 1970, that number had dropped down to about 36%. Now, the government had come to its senses and realized it needed to change, but the Canadian people were not happy about this flood of people with who, you know, didn't look like Northern Europeans, who were all of a sudden coming into the country in unprecedented numbers. So Trudeau took office having to deal with that crisis. Trudeau's solution in 1971 was to launch the world's first policy of official multiculturalism. He announced in a bombshell speech in Parliament in October of that year that henceforth Canada would not have a single culture or two cultures, it would be open to all cultures, and that all cultures would be equally Canadian, so long as newcomers were willing to do the work to integrate into Canadian society. And then he backed it up with very heavy, intense government spending on two things, on integration efforts, but also on public relations to try and convince Canadians that pluralism, that diversity was was a feature, not a bug, that it made Canada more Canadian and not less. And very quickly, these two halves of the policy, an economic-based immigration policy and multiculturalism policy, started to reinforce one another. On the one side, the economic emphasis ensured that Canadian immigrants started to contribute in material terms to the country's economy and to Canadian society. Canadian immigrants to this day are among the most successful in the world. They have the highest rate of college education in the OECD. They consume less benefits than native-born Canadians. They start businesses at higher-born rates, although that's true of many immigrant populations. So Canadians were seeing the practical benefits of the change, and then at the same time, the government was emphasizing the sort of the cultural benefits of the change. But the really interesting thing about multiculturalism is, there again, it was not chosen by or adopted by Trudeau because it was the enlightened thing to do. Trudeau was actually trying to solve a different problem, which was, when he took office in 1968, Canada's long Cold War between its French and its English populations had just become a hot one. Canadians were actually killing other Canadians over politics. Bombs were going off in Montreal, and Quebec was threatening to secede. And Trudeau's first attempt to address this was to establish what was known as the Official Languages Act, to declare that from that point forward, English and French, and until then French had been really treated as a second-class language in Canada, and French Canadians had been treated as second-class citizens, the two languages would be henceforth given equal standing. The French Canadians loved it, Anglo-Canadians not so much, but the people who were really angry about it were the full third of the population who were neither Francophone nor Anglophone, but were immigrants from Eastern Europe or Southern Europe, and who were a key Liberal Party support base, and they didn't want French or English to be their official language. This attempt to address the problem blew up in Trudeau's face, and so he had to swing for the fences and address the immigrant issue at the same time, and so that's why he adopted this policy, multiculturalism, which has become a hallmark of Canadian identity today. And, you know, it's really remarkable at a time when multiculturalism is now a dirty word in most places and has been openly denounced by former British Prime Minister David Cameron and Angela Merkel. Canadians love it so much that when Canadians were polled a few years ago on what made them proudest of their country, multiculturalism came in second ahead of hockey, which is amazing. And multiculturalism actually sells beer in Canada. And in 2015, Molson's main advertising campaign involved a mysterious beer fridge that appeared on Canadian streets. And there was lots of footage of Canadians trying to figure out how to open it because it was locked. And gradually they figured out that there was a microphone and there were six lights. And someone finally said, "I'm a Canadian," into the mic, and one of the lights went off. And so they thought, oh, okay, now, so people started trying other catchphrases, all in English, no more lights went off. Finally, someone else came up and said, "Je suis Canadien," and the second of the six lights went off. And they couldn't get all six until they could find people who could say, "I'm Canadian," in four other languages. And this was the main beer campaign for the summer of 2015. Try to imagine that in this country.
But this point about Trudeau and that this came out of a moment of crisis in some ways oddly gives me hope, because if anything, we are at a moment of crisis in terms of immigration. So where do you think there are places in the world that could, I mean, maybe a lot of places can learn from it, but could actually adopt some of these things?
Well, you know, I think many countries could shift their immigration policy slightly, if not overwhelmingly, in the direction of or put more emphasis on the economy, to become a little bit more selective while maintaining, you know, Canada, well, I should say, finish my sentence, while maintaining things like large flows of refugees, family reunification. And Canada has a sizable family reunification program as well. So I don't mean to suggest it's a heartless policy that is only focused on material benefits. The United States could do it. Many European countries could do it as well. Now, the common critique of talk about the Canadian exception, the counter argument is that Canada got lucky in two ways. One, it's vast. And two, it has very little problem with illegal immigration, simply because it is surrounded by oceans on two sides, the Arctic to the north and the United States to the south. My response to that is that, yes, Canada doesn't have much of a problem with illegal immigration. The rate is about 3 to 6% in Canada today versus something over 10% in the United States. But it's interesting to note that the United Kingdom, which is also surrounded by water and has virtually no problem with illegal immigration, in fact, the number is exactly the same as it is in Canada, the population there opposes immigration policy like Canada's, or an open immigration policy 2 to 3 times higher than the Canadian public does. And what that shows is the role that, you know, smart government policies can play. So lots of countries, in short, can do what Canada did.
The book is, for those of you who have not had the chance to read it yet, is organized kind of around these 10 different fixes or stories. And one thing I found really compelling is that, and you said this book is about role models, not just success stories. And yet, not all of these are places that are easily embraced. Which of these chapters was the most difficult for you to write from that perspective? You kind of had to, I don't want to say hold your nose, but...
Sure. For those of you who have not yet bought my book, well, I'll tell you that the book is structured as 10 individual stories. Each chapter is a story of how one government somewhere in the world tackled one supposedly impossible political or an economic problem that many countries have struggled with for decades. But, you know, as Annie just said, a couple of the countries in the book are not ones you can hold up as an across-the-board example of what, you know, how to govern. They include Singapore, which has made extraordinary progress virtually eradicating corruption, and Rwanda, and the story of how Rwanda put itself back together after the civil war and genocide of 1994. Rwanda has made extraordinary progress, and ethnic violence is almost inconceivable in Rwanda today, but its president, Paul Kagame, while he does a lot of really impressive stuff on the development side and on in addressing the genocide, has become increasingly authoritarian. And so he's not somebody that I would hold up as a model leader. I also have a chapter on Mexico and talk about the current president, who currently has the lowest poll figures of any president in Mexican history. And another of my heroes is former President Lula from Brazil, who's in a little bit of trouble right now himself. So,
and South Korea also has.
And so I also tell the story of South Korea and its 50 years of extraordinary economic growth. The problem that South Korea has solved is what's known as the middle income trap. It turns out to be very easy for poor countries to get to middle income, to raise their GDP up to an average of about $10,000 to $14,000 a year. But it turns out to be extraordinarily difficult to keep growing past that point. And countries tend to get stuck in the middle level. And the problem is so difficult that since World War II, only 13 countries have made it successfully from poor to rich, whereas something like 70 have made it from poor to middle income. South Korea is one of the ones that did. But for the first 25 years of its growth, it was ruled by authoritarian military dictators who were nasty guys in lots of ways. So why do I write about these countries nonetheless and hold them up as models? The book is not, there's a reason it's not subtitled The Lives of the Saints. It's not intended to canonize any of the leaders that I write about, nor is it intended to say that everything these countries or these governments or these individuals did was right. It's merely to point out that at one specific point in history, in some cases the stories are long-term, in some cases they're much more specific, these countries figured out the problem, the answer to a problem that the rest of us are still struggling with. And I was very careful when writing about non-democratic or otherwise problematic countries to make sure that the part of the story that I was writing about and that I was celebrating wasn't connected to the nastier aspects of those countries' leaders. So yes, Singapore was an authoritarian and is still, although less so, an authoritarian country, but you don't have to be authoritarian to follow Singapore's lessons on combating corruption. And you don't need to be authoritarian to learn from what Rwanda did in reconciling after a civil war, etc. In 1994, as you all probably know, Rwanda had what may have been the worst, or one of, if not the worst, one of the worst genocides since the Second World War. In 3 months, somewhere between 800,000 and a million Rwandans were butchered. Rwanda is a multi-ethnic society made up mostly of Hutus and Tutsis. The Tutsis were a small minority, traditionally the ruling class, and they were almost wiped out. And it was an extraordinarily bloody and extraordinarily intimate genocide because the killing was done mostly with machetes, and it was neighbors killing neighbors because Rwanda was a very, there was a ton of intermarriage. Hutus and Tutsis live right next to each other. By the killing only ended when Paul Kagame, who was then the leader of a rebel Tutsi army, seized control of the country and overthrew the old Hutu government and stopped the killing. He was vice president until 2000. In 2000, he became president. In 2000, 6 years after the genocide, Rwanda was still one of the most miserable places on earth. You had a population of about 4 million people, in which up to a million people, or a million adults, were suspected of having been complicit in the genocide. Two-thirds of the youth population was estimated to be suffering from PTSD because virtually 99% of the population had witnessed acts of killing in 1994. The country's infrastructure didn't exist. There were 800 judges in Rwanda before the genocide, barely 50 had survived, and the World Bank had declared the country non-viable in 1995. Malaria and other communicable diseases were ravaging the population, and so that was the country that Kagame inherited when he became president in 2000. Now he did a lot of things to set the country on the right course. He established a monopoly on force. He ended the killing. He invested extremely heavily in economic development by pouring a ton of resources into education. He provided universal education for almost free. He provided universal health care. He embraced outside expertise. Rwanda became a sort of development experts petri dish and fantasy land because the government was interested in the sort of more boldest and most courageous development programs, so much so that Paul Farmer, the leader of, Partners in Health, has said that Rwanda was his favorite country in the world in which to work because you had a meeting with the president, you proposed an interesting a policy, and you could start work the next day. But Rwanda also had this huge problem with justice and reconciliation. And as I said, up to a million people were suspected of being complicit. You still had a majority Hutu population, and a minority Tutsi population that were living very uneasily with one another. And Rwanda had virtually no court system with which to deal with it. There were 180,000 suspects in jail. Rwanda had 13 jails. And so the conditions in these prisons were absolutely horrific. People were dying in droves. And Rwanda had to do something about it. It couldn't process them through the regular court system because it was estimated that it would take 200 years to clear all of the cases, given the resources that they had. The UN had set up a criminal tribunal in Tanzania right next door. It processed very slowly, very few cases. over the course of its 20-year life, it would process 55 cases. So Rwanda couldn't use conventional justice, but Rwanda also didn't want to use what was then in vogue, what's known as a truth commission, which is what South Africa had done after its transition to democracy. Because truth commissions, which are not, so to back up, trials tend to be very good after a crime is concerned, has been committed, at getting you justice, but not necessarily the truth, because the rules of criminal procedure mean you can't just get up and say whatever you want to say in a trial. There are very strict limits on it. So they're not very good at establishing a historical record. Truth commissions are supposed to be very good at doing that, but the way they do it is they generally give malefactors amnesty if they'll get up and they'll speak openly. Rwanda had too much had suffered too much and experienced too much trauma to be comfortable with that either. And so what Kagame did was split the difference and adopt something known as Gacaca, which was a court system based on a traditional Rwandan method of dispute settlement. The term is a Kinyarwanda word that literally means justice in the grass. And what he essentially did was set up 12,000 tribunals in villages across the country, staffed by and run by ordinary Rwandan citizens, where anyone could come forward and speak. And these cases, these courts managed over the course of about 5 years to clear the enormous backlog, to give everyone a chance to speak, and to impose criminal sentences where necessary. But the courts also emphasized reconciliation by not granting amnesty, but by reducing prison terms if people would confess openly to their crimes. And the courts also tended to use community service as punishment rather than jail time. And the reason that that was so effective is because it sent Hutu genocidaire into traumatized villages, often into villages where they had killed people's fathers and brothers and wives, to start performing labor. And so it forced the people to start living together again. And all of this proved very effective.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Jonathan Tepperman, Managing Editor of Foreign Affairs. He's the author of a book entitled The Fix: How Nations Survive and Thrive in a World in Decline. He's in conversation with Annie Maxwell. She's president of the Skoll Global Threats Fund. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. The World Affairs Council is a membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. And now back to our conversation.
Kagame, at the same time, kept promising that he was going to leave office after the next election. The Constitution limited him to two terms. And so the big hope was that when his term expired this year, or is it next year? I think it's next year, he would step down. He recently announced that because it was the will of the Rwandan people that he would stay on, he is not going to be leaving power. Meanwhile, he had, and I realize this answer is going on too long already, and I apologize, but he had imposed a lot of restrictions on the press, on free expression, in the early days after the genocide. And these were sort of understandable in the beginning, because tensions were so high that to allow people to speak freely about the divisions in society would have been dangerous. And one of Kagame's tactics was to declare Rwanda a race-blind society by forbidding all discussion of ethnic difference. And that also proved useful in the early days. But the fact is, the matter is now, it's 2016, it's been 22 years since the Civil War, and a lot of these restrictions are no longer necessary, and yet Kagame is keeping them in place. And so he's become an incredibly divisive figure. He's lauded by the development community and people like Tony Blair and Bill Clinton and Bill Gates and a lot of other global leaders continue to celebrate him, and he's despised by the human rights community because he's become increasingly authoritarian. And so I really worried that in writing about him and going to Rwanda and interviewing him, I would be increasing his public profile in ways that he would find, you know, very satisfying, and that people who knew the story would attack me for being naive. And so I tried to be very careful in when I eventually wrote the story, to talk about all of his abuses as well as his accomplishments and make the point that I'm not saying that anybody should rule the way that Kagame has ruled, but that you can learn a lot from the way that he dealt with genocide.
As you note in the story of South Korea, Park was killed by his, quote, his intelligence chief, who shot him in the face over dinner one night during an argument for whether to crush the latest flare-up of pro-democracy demonstrations. He was obviously not a very likable man in terms of his relationships with the people. And you don't have to go to that kind of extreme, even if you look at kind of revered civil rights leaders. They have very complicated personal histories, and often with a lot of womanizing and of the sorts. And so I'm just wondering, as you kind of have looked for were looking for the fix, did you find that you could actually find leaders who were able to both do the fix and be good people?
Yes, sure. There are in the books a number of figures who are it's very hard to criticize. One is the founder of independent Botswana, a guy named Seretse Khama, who was an extraordinary leader, incredibly frugal, incredibly clean, incredibly devoted to democracy, who led by example, who relinquished power, who shared power, and what was more extraordinary, and who also, unlike many leaders of post-colonial African states, welcomed the whites who had lived in Botswana under British colonial rule to stay on after independence and never indigenize the country's civil service. Many of Botswana's neighbors, Zambia, Congo to the north, the first thing they did when they became independent was throw out all the whites who were working in the country. And in cases of like Zimbabwe, we've seen they've also they appropriated their land and property. What Khama said was that we are going to become a race-blind nation, having suffered tremendously under racist colonialism myself. The last thing I want to do is perpetuate that. So anyone who wants to stay and contribute can become a Botswanan. So, you know, he is an example of a leader who's got it right in just about every way.
So we have a student journalist here who's trying to launch an international relations column in their school paper, and asks, how do you keep your writing from being partisan or skewed while still providing analysis?
It's a tough
question. I know, it's the high schoolers that'll get you.
Yeah. the honest answer is that I don't, because I can't. We all have biases, and we can't keep the biases out of our work. We have to fight very hard to keep ourselves honest, and one of the ways to do that is to make sure that you rely on the data and numbers and do your research and talk to as many people as possible. And challenge yourself when you're writing a particular story making a particular argument at every step along the way. But we're still going to come out with our biases and probably betray them.
One of your biases, actually, as you see through the book, is this kind of bias towards optimism, which is not a bad one to have. And there's a question from the audience about kind of these case studies, which of these actually gives you the most hope?
I think I'll answer by starting with the problems that seem most threatening today and most irrational. I'm often asked what country in the world I think is most apt or susceptible or ripe for the kind of fixes that I talk about in the book. And the answer I often give is the United States. Now, the United States is not in a crisis comparable to many of the ones that I write about in the book. A lot of the countries, they sort of turned the corner when things were unimaginably bad and couldn't get any worse. The United States is not there yet. As bad as things look in the U.S. today, believe it or not, as bad as things look, they immediately start to look a lot worse when you start to look at virtually every other country in the world, except maybe for Canada, of course. but on economic issues, political paralysis, lack of innovation. Europe is this. Europe's struggles are much greater than the United States, and the other reason I think the United States is so it would be such a good target for or patient is because all of our problems here are self-created. They're not the result of man-made disasters. They're not the result of natural forces. They're because of decisions that we Americans, and yes, I'm now an American as well as a Canadian, are making ourselves about how to run the country. And I think that means that they are correctable as well, because these are human decisions and humans are capable of making other decisions. So and of the problems that we're struggling with now, two of the greatest are immigration and political gridlock. And so the story of how Canada fixed its immigration system and how Mexico, a country that today can't seem to get anything right, in 2012 and 2013 ended a political paralysis that was every bit as bitter as the divide that currently separates Democrats and Republicans in the United States today, gives me a lot of hope.
There is a question about, specifically about Rwanda and Kagame's personality and leadership, and you know, is how much of this is derived from his kind of charisma, which I think is something that comes up through the book. Right. But I would extend that beyond just Rwanda and maybe talking about a place like Brazil, and how much does the kind of great leader apply.
So I have a line in the book, in the conclusion, where I write that I don't subscribe to the great man theory of history. And what I mean by that is I don't want the book to suggest that you need to have a leader of superhuman capabilities and attributes in order to achieve the kind of success that the countries in my book have. And I take pains to point out that a lot of the leaders that I write about, you know, they have the flaws that we've already talked about. They also, it's not exactly like they were born to greatness. So Lula, who we've already just mentioned, he ran for president three times and failed before he was finally elected in 2001, and was very close to becoming the perennial also-ran of Brazilian politics. Michael Bloomberg, who I write about in a chapter about New York City, one of my stories is about a city and not about a country, you know, famously was fired from his first job on Wall Street. Peña Nieto, the president of Mexico, who's today in so much trouble, also seemed enormously unimpressive when he first became president in 2012. The first Democratic president of Indonesia, a man named Abdurrahman Wahid, was a man who was so powerfully uncharismatic that he once fell asleep in the middle of his own speech. So, you know, you don't have to be a superhero to do what these leaders did. But I do emphasize the fact that having the right policies isn't enough. You have to also get the politics right, at least if you're in a democratic society, because unless you do the politics, you're never going to get your policies adopted. And so it is the case that a lot of these leaders, like Trudeau and like Lula, were master politicians. But you know, what I find so interesting about them is inevitably they ended up serving their constituents in unexpected ways and building unexpected coalitions. And one of the things that unites all the leaders in the book, as well as their mastery of politics and policymaking, was their pragmatism. None of the leaders in the book were ideologues in office. They may have risen to power that way, but they were ruthless pragmatists in the way that they governed. People who would never let ideology or party or philosophy or tribe or custom stand in the way of the search for the best answer. They would start with the facts of the case, look and cast their net as broadly as they could for the right answer, and then steal it. And they didn't care where it came from, whether it came from another party or another country, and whether it violated the traditional precepts of their own political base. If they felt it was the right thing to do, they did it, and then they tried to sell it.
Writing this book has been a journey of both the literal in terms of the number of interviews that you've had to do, and figurative. So from everything you've learned from this, what would be your advice to the incoming president as they manage their inbox of the things they need to think about?
Two or three takeaways I would emphasize. The first is the vital role that this kind of pragmatism we've just been talking about plays, that you're never going to solve big problems, let alone the particular problems that we face today, including the polarization of American society, if you rule on behalf of one segment of the population, and if you rule with a sort of unreflective devotion to a particular set of ideas. The George W. Bush administration is sort of the prime example, or at least the first 4 years, of what not to do. 2001, the country was attacked. The administration immediately had its answer ready to go, and that was to respond by attacking Iraq. And it didn't matter what the evidence said. In fact, they proceeded to ignore an enormous body of evidence because they knew their solution from the moment the country was attacked. So you've got to be pragmatic. You have to focus on politics as well as policy. And this is, I think, one of the key things that this current administration, the Obama administration, has gotten wrong consistently. Not all the time. And it's a great irony that this has been a problem for this particular president, who's one of the most gifted communicators that we've ever had in that office. But he has, in many cases, in my humble opinion, neglected the kind of retail politics, the card playing and golf outings and lunches and drinks that are necessary to forge coalitions and that make Washington work. There's some more smaller lessons, like don't be afraid to adopt messy, complicated solutions that don't make anybody completely happy, but give everybody sort of just enough that they can buy in. Because I would argue, in fact, that in government policymaking, virtue lies in precisely that, in not giving any sector of society everything that they want. Because if you do that, you guarantee that other people are going to be unhappy. They have to be. The more that you can split the difference, the better. Now, a lot of this sounds like common sense, and it is. But in my own defense, what I would say is that common sense just ain't so common in politics. And so these rules may sound basic, but if they could actually be recalled and applied, they would prove, as they do in the book, the stories in the book, very effective. And the last thing that I would say, which sounds a bit hokey, is to not give up hope. One of the things that the stories that I tell in this book show is that countries can pull themselves back from the most enormous, almost unimaginable crises. And that, in fact, those are often precisely the moments when breakthroughs occur, because of the way that crises can sweep away the obstacles that block reform under ordinary circumstances, the political obstacles, the technocratic obstacles. Countries face crises all the time, but what all of the smart leaders in this book realized is the opportunity that their crises gave them, and they used them to the utmost.
There is a question, kind of, I think this is pivoting a bit to just you and your foreign affairs expertise, but what do you feel are the biggest existential threats for our president, for the future president, and for the U.S.?
It's a good question. I'm going to say something which may sound controversial, maybe not. I don't think terrorism is an existential threat.
Why is that?
The number of Americans killed every year in terrorist attacks is vanishingly small. More Americans are hit by lightning every year than die in terrorist attacks. More Americans drown in their bathtubs every year than die in terrorist attacks. The number of Americans who've been killed by terrorism since September 11th, 2001 is something like 100 or 150. Mm-hmm. It's minuscule. And that's compared to more than 40,000 Americans who've been killed in handgun incidents, and double or triple that figure who've been killed in car accidents. The existential threat, if it's there, comes in overreacting, in responding the wrong way to terrorism, but not in the terrorism itself. And then there are a lot of scary trends in the world. There are a lot of countries that are behaving in scary manners today. None of these are represent existential threats to the United States either. Not China, not Russia, for the simple reason that the United States is so overwhelmingly preponderant today in terms of wealth, in terms of innovation, and in terms of its military power, that none of these countries can offer real competition. Climate change. Now, there is a real existential threat. You know, that defines the idea of an existential threat. Political dysfunction, gridlock, the failure of our legislative branch to legislate, that potentially represents an existential threat, because until that is resolved in some fashion, none of these other problems can be addressed.
In your travels and research, I mean, how many of these fixes have you seen applied to big issues, transnational issues like climate change?
None of them directly. There are lessons that can be learned from these stories. I think some that can be applied internationally, mm-hmm. but the problems are so much more complicated because nobody rules the international system, because our international institutions are not working very well. Some of the lessons that I write about in the book are some of the keys to success. Being pragmatic, coming up with win-win solutions that split the difference, the dogged pursuit of a solution, the need to emphasize the political side as well as the policy side. We have seen this administration take that approach on a number of issues. I think the Iran nuclear deal is a really good example. What the administration has done on climate is another good example. Both what the president has done through his own executive authority in imposing or attempting to impose regulations, new regulations on things like the country's electrical plants, and what he's done in not waiting for the entire international system, but hammering out bilateral deals with the Chinese, for example.
Mm-hmm. I'm a sucker for questions from high schoolers, because I think they get to the heart of the matter. If in the book we talked about what was most hopeful, which of these do you think is the hardest to battle? And this is from Mills High School.
Which of these problems do I think is the hardest to battle?
Questions from high schoolers?
Yeah, exactly. It's a tough one. There are a lot of good candidates. Gridlock is really, really hard. It's even harder in the United States than it is in Mexico, because we have, in the last decades, configured our political system in a way that makes bipartisan cooperation more difficult by gerrymandering and by allowing money to play the role in politics that it does. So it's going to be really, really tough here to work that one out. Immigration reform, not so much.
But the immigration reform, I mean, it seems like, and this is brought up in some of the mm-hmm. questions, yes, Canada's been able to pull this off, mm-hmm. but the UK has had a big push on multiculturalism. It is technically right. part of the US's DNA as well, except you've seen these huge kind of waves of racism within our country.
Right.
I mean, how do you make that leap then?
So the tough question, I think, is what you do in the United States when you've allowed the populist genie out of the bottle. Mm-hmm. You know, if the United States had started... the U.S. government has started educating its population the way the Canadian government did back in the 1960s about the virtues of this stuff, I don't think we would be in the problem that we are in the straits that we are today. But the fact of the matter is, Washington didn't, and we are now where we are. And the question is, how do you start to re-educate the population? You know, I think and I hope that if you put in place the right policies and you you sell them to the public very vigorously, the public will come around in time. But you have to, that takes enormous guts for a politician to do. And what I would emphasize, and this is another lesson that I learned from looking at the leaders in this book, is you have to be prepared to fail, and you have to be prepared to put your career on the line. Many of the changes that these leaders made took years to materialize. Mexico today is a really good example. In 2012, 2013, the government made incredibly far-reaching economic reforms. Economic reforms, structural reforms, classically take a long time, 5, 7, 10 years to pay off. And in the meantime, voters don't feel their lives changing. And so they get angry and they tend to punish politicians. That's why so few politicians have the guts to embrace fight for those kind of changes while they're in office, because they have to accept the fact that they may personally not get the payoff. So it requires leaders who are, and again, this is going to sound really hokey, willing to put the good of their country over their own political prospects.
Does this old adage of, right, you campaign in poetry and you govern in prose, and I think you hear many people in Secretary Clinton's camp actually say, that's, don't worry about her right now because she's going to be able to govern in prose. What I think I hear you saying is that you also need to govern in poetry in some ways.
Again, I think that's where this administration has fallen down. Mm-hmm. There have been some extraordinarily beautiful poems, but they've been very, very few and far between.
So as you approached your first book, what do you feel like has been the best experience that has helped you prepare you for this in going on this journey?
There were a lot of actually advantages to having waited as long as I did to write my first book. And that was I had so much experience writing and editing myself that when I finally set out to do this, I knew how to construct a story. I knew how to make an argument. I knew how to do the research. I didn't know how to write a book. And so what I decided to do was to write a book that was comprised essentially of 10 magazine articles, because I knew how to write magazine articles.
You cheated.
And I absolutely cheated. I stole promiscuously from all kinds of other books, models, and ways of approaching. I asked for advice from everybody that I could think of, every more senior or more accomplished journalist who would give me the time of day. And then the other thing that proved really effective was that my wife and I found out that we were pregnant with our first child the same week that I signed the book contract. Now, on the one hand, that was absolutely terrifying, because it was like deciding that you're going to run a marathon and then finding out that you're going to run it on your hands the next day. I was going to do two things that I've been frightened of doing my entire life at the same time. But boy, having a child on the way is a powerful motivator to actually get your book written. And my ambition was to get the 8 of the 10 chapters done before my son Leo was born. I only got 6 done, but knowing that he was coming sure kept me at my desk.
If you were writing this book 20, 30 years in time and looking back at our generation, what is the story that you hope you can tell your kids about the fix? What are the things that you hope we have fixed by that time?
I would return to the answer I gave a few minutes ago about the great global crisis that we faced. And hopefully my son and I won't be talking about the extinct fishes that I used to eat when I was writing the book, and the submerged island of Brooklyn on which I used to live. But instead, I'll be able to say we faced these enormous crises, and things looked like they couldn't get any worse, and we turned the corner. And so you're not living in a hot, swampy, or arid country that we feared that you might be living in. You can still occasionally eat red snapper, 'cause we figured out how to keep ourselves in check.
I hope that we are around to read that book. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for tonight. On behalf of the World Affairs, I'd ask you to join me in thanking Jonathan Tepperman for his excellent discussion.
Thank you, and thank all of you.
And thank you to the audience as well for your terrific questions.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a membership organization, and we're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at www.worldaffairs.org. This program featured Jonathan Tepperman. He's managing editor of Foreign Affairs, and he's the author of a new book entitled The Fix: How Nations Survive and Thrive in a World in Decline. He was in conversation with Annie Maxwell. She's president of Skoll Global Threats Fund. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Our recording engineer is Jane Heaven. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.